This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For a lot of people, email is better than the post office, better than a phone call. Email is electronic mail sent through a computer network. People use email for everything from business to romance. John Seabrook is a staff writer for The New Yorker who only recently started getting and sending email. After publishing a piece about Bill Gates, the head of the software company Microsoft Word, Seabrook was delighted to get lots of email from readers. Until he was flamed. A flame is a derogatory or obscene message sent through the email. Getting flamed unnerved Seabrook and prompted him to write a piece about his email adventures called My First Flame, which was published in last week's New Yorker. I asked him to describe that flame.
It was a letter that a very rude message. I'm trying to paraphrase for the radio, and it makes me aware of how different talk is on the internet than talk on the radio. It accused me. It was a random string of obscene insults, really. I mean, the scatological imagery was almost poetically intense. I mean, it was a rather impressive document. I'm familiar with the guy's work who wrote me The Flame, and I have to say his flame is the best work of his that I've seen. And people are now kind of quoting some of the better lines to me as I kind of go around town. I mean, it's kind of funny now to have the people sort of say these things, but at the time it was quite devastating.
Well, after you got flamed, you called your computer service to complain. What was their reaction?
Well, I didn't call them. I emailed them.
Oh, excuse me. How foolish.
Of course. And I use a commercial service. You pay a subscription. It gives them a little bit more authority over what goes on their system than, you know, a university service might have. And they do try to kind of keep the tone at a certain level. Their response to me was that because this message was a private message and not as opposed to a message that was publicly posted in a forum somewhere, that they had no way of monitoring its content, which I think is probably a good thing because the only way they could monitor the content would be to read your mail or to run keyword searches on words that they find objectionable. And that would turn the thing into kind of a police state. So I don't criticize CompuServe for not deleting the guy's message before it got to me. I was just asking them because I didn't know exactly what their policy was, and they said they couldn't do it. So,
did you get more email, more flames?
Not from him. I did get a little bit of a broiling back from him when I sent him my reply to his first flame to me. But now, however, now that I have written a piece in which I have talked about how my feelings were hurt in getting flamed, it's kind of open season, on me. And, people have been very nice. There are many people who have sent me wonderful email messages and they outnumber the nasty ones, but I don't know. Maybe I'm naive. I mean, people keep saying to me, you're naive. But the other thing I guess I should say is that when you go online and when you join an electronic community, you can't help but kind of hope that it's going to be a better world, or at least I did. I mean, people join these communities because they're a little lonely in their lives or they don't have friends or they don't have a chance to talk about the kinds of issues that they want to talk about because the people who live around them or work around them aren't interested in them. So you get on one of these services and you begin meeting and talking to people who, you know, share your unique interests in whatever it is, you know, in fiddler crabs or in politics or in sex or whatever. And you kind of can't help but start thinking this is kind of a utopia. And then you get flamed and your kind of utopian experience is over. Or at least it's made a little bit more realistic. And yet there's a thing in the back, at least in my back of my mind, that you keep wishing that it could be better. I mean, I'm just not quite ready to give up that people can't behave in a slightly more decent manner on the internet than they do in the real world. I'm struggling trying to hold on to that in face of great odds.
Do you have any information on who the person was who sent you your first flame?
Sure, I know who it was.
Oh, you know exactly who it was?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I chose not to publish his name because, partly because, I mean, he never explained why. I mean, if he just explained why, it would have maybe been a lot better. He never kind of explained why he sent it. But I thought, well, maybe the guy was drunk or something. This is the other thing about communicating with people over the computer. You don't know if they're drunk or stoned or what's going on when they're talking to you, which even on a telephone, you kind of have a pretty good clue. So, you know, maybe he made a terrible mistake, and by publishing his name in the piece, I would kind of damage his career. And you know, I felt like that would have been an even greater flame than the one he sent me. And it just didn't feel like the right thing to do.
Now, you write for The New Yorker, and The New Yorker is one of, or perhaps the best edited magazine in the country. So you're used to editing that passes through many, you're used to writing things that pass through many layers of editing before they're published.
Right.
Now you're writing on email where you're, you know, when you write to someone, there's no editing at all. When they write back to you, of course, there's no editing at all. Have you been interested in watching the language and syntax and stylistics that people use in the email?
It's been fascinating. One of the great things about the internet is because it's really all made out of words. People are constantly inventing new words to just sort of from the joy of invention, or sometimes they invent acronyms to stand for words because typing is harder than talking. So there are all these sort of stylistic innovations and grammatical innovations or just sort of lack of grammar and lack of spelling. I think the other great thing is that, or appalling thing, depending on your point of view, is that people don't really need to know how to spell any, and people don't care. I mean, people on the internet don't care whether you spell things correctly for the most part. And a lot of people don't take the trouble to get it right. At any rate, The New Yorker, on the other hand, represents, I think, among all American kind of cultural institutions, it's at the top of representing a sort of a certain kind of a style. It has a certain sort of civility in the way it uses language, and there are all kinds of shibboleths that exist in usage at The New Yorker that have grown up over its 79-year history that are hard to explain, but they exist. As a writer, you kind of encounter these when you use one of these words. Like, for example, if you use the word balding at The New Yorker, the copy editors change it to partially bald. And once I asked about this, and I was told that the reason for it was because Mr. Sean, William Sean, who was the editor of The New Yorker for a long time, thought that the word balding was insensitive because it implied the person was going to go more bald. whereas partially bald, at least, you know, left it open that they weren't going to go any more bald than they are now. So when I was closing this piece on email and on the internet, I kind of had these two cultures smushed up against each other. And we stayed up late into the night trying to figure out all these things about, you know, well, okay, should we put a dash in online? Should we make database one word or two words? Should we capitalize the E in email, or should we make it a small E? There are all these new words that had never been used in The New Yorker before, and, you know, we didn't know how to deal with them. It was fascinating.
Once you're on the internet, If you're a journalist and you're writing pieces as you are, the feedback not only comes to you on your email, but you could tap into other bulletin boards and see what other people are saying about you. They might be having a conversation about your piece, especially this is true when your piece is about something near and dear to the hearts of people who are signed on, such as email.
Right.
So what's it like for you to read people having a conversation about you instead of speaking directly to you about your work?
It's scary. I sort of feel like sometimes that I've kind of mixed up some weird potion in the basement and taken a drink of it and I'm invisible. I mean, you have this sort of sensation that people are, it's like that fantasy of wanting to go to your own funeral or something like that. People are talking about you in a way that they do in the real world when you're not around, but they never do it when you are around. because people just don't do that in the real world, but they do it on bulletin boards. You know, I for a journalist, it's a very interesting experience. A lot of journalists, I think, particularly people who write for news magazines or magazines like The New Yorker, are kind of cut off from their readers in a way, and they don't get the kind of critical feedback that, you know, like an actor who is on Broadway reads the reviews the next day and, you know, somebody says they're awful. And, I mean, I used to read those reviews and think, my God, how does that person deal with it? You know, it's a new thing for journalists, I think. But like I said before, I think in the long run, I think it's good. If you just can allow it not to crush you. There was a piece in Newsweek a few weeks ago, a cover story about men and women on the internet, and that was really flamed on the well. I mean, worse than my piece probably. And I talked to the woman who wrote it. She called me on the phone after my piece came out saying, thank you for saying these things. And I think she was really hurt. I mean, really quite hurt. And I think kind of had a lot of trepidation about ever writing about this subject again. I mean, I guess that would be the bad side if journalists start kind of qualifying what they think is the truth because they're afraid of what, you know, people will say about them on a bulletin board. But I don't intend to do that.
John Seabrook is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Coming up, we talk with Stuart Brand, a founder of the computer conference system The Well. This is Fresh Air. We just heard from John Seabrook, a newcomer to computer communications. Stuart Brand is a veteran. He co-founded The Well, a computer conference system which originated in the San Francisco Bay Area and now connects people from around the country. The Well is an acronym for Whole Earth Electronic Link. Brand is also the creator of the Whole Earth Catalog. He has a new book called How Buildings Learn, What Happens After They're Built. Stuart Brand told me he's been flamed plenty of times. He says it got particularly bad while he was on the board of The Well. In fact, that's one of the reasons he resigned. He always knew who was sending the obnoxious messages because you have to identify yourself on The Well. In fact, The Well software doesn't allow anonymity. Brand told me why it was designed that way.
I encountered an experience on a system called Eyes back in the early 1980s, where a small group of people, very bright corporate and academic people, were 30 or 40 of them on a system together and having important discussions about important issues of the day. And anonymity was permitted on Eyes, and one member of that group started to go after other people in a kind of teasing way from a position of anonymity, and it just blew the trust in the group. And we never really got it back. And so that convinced me that anonymity, while really good in principle, because it allows whistleblowing and people to tell deeply personal stories and so on, in practice it was always going to be a problem.
Are there other big questions of conduct now on The Well and on the internet in general?
I understand that there's... The internet is taking off now, kind of the way fax did a few years ago. And the structure is not like a highway, it's like an epidemic. And by, everybody catches it in order to stay in business or to stay current with things going on. And when you have a takeoff like that, you're going to get strange behavior for a while until things sort out.
So what kind of strange behavior are you seeing now as more and more people sign onto the internet?
They get drunk with freedom, and there's always a kind of an intoxication that goes with new tools in new situations where there's not a whole lot of conventions yet about how to do things. And so people find they can insult, or people find that they can invade other discussions, and so they insult and invade.
What are some of the conventions that guide people's behavior now?
If one is flamed, the most sensible thing to do is just let it go, either an email or as a comment in a public conference. Because if you respond, you will inflame the flamer and probably other people as well, and the subject of discussion will just go away.
Mm-hmm. When John Seabrook was flamed, one of his first responses was to call the commercial computer conference system that he belongs to and say, look, this terrible thing happened to me. You got to do something. And their reaction was basically, well, you know, we have open communications. I would, you know, call us if it happens again. But there isn't a way of punishing somebody's behavior or preventing such mail from getting sent. Do you think there should be, or do you think that would be a big mistake?
Most of these things are correctable either in the human social interaction where you agree on certain forms of behavior, or they're correctable by having different pockets. For example, on the well, there's a couple of hundred different conferences, and each conference will typically have its own standards of behavior. So, for example, there's a writer's conference in which people are constantly kind to each other. Writers are so vulnerable, especially while they're writing, they realize that this could only be done in a non-critical atmosphere. Other conferences are fierce and wild, and if you go there, that's what you expect to find. So that's one solution. Another solution is in the software. If you forbid anonymity, you get different behavior. If you allow it, you get different behavior. You can have what are called bozo filters, where if there's someone who just irks you every time you see a posting from them, you can arrange so that you never see their postings.
Now, how did you co-found The Well? What was the principle behind it?
The Well was offered to me as a set of half-baked software and a little bit of money in a VAX back in 1984. VAX was a mini computer at the time. And having had experience with other systems, what I thought we should probably do is try having a regional system without anonymity. And the main thing with these systems is the initial state. And so what we did is brought in people who were primarily either hackers or journalists or writers. The hackers, because we needed them to help make the system work and to help defend it. Writers, because they could write well and would bring a level of discourse that would inform everything. And also having journalists have free accounts was our entire marketing strategy.
That's interesting. And did the strategy work?
Brilliantly. I mean, it was no other system gets so much ink still.
And what about the level of discourse, having brought on all those writers at the start?
It's amazing. You could actually see people becoming writers on The Well and on other systems, because there they are. They're having to communicate in a very compressed form, because people won't typically read more than one screen at a time, and just by writing and reading. And people started writing well, and other people would value what they'd written and ask if they could use it in some publication, and pretty soon they're getting paid to write in publications, and we saw a number of professional writers come into existence on The Well and elsewhere.
You were part of the pranksters, the group of people who traveled on the bus with Ken Kesey and so on in the 1960s, really important group in the hippie subculture of the 60s. Then you moved on, did the Whole Earth Catalog, and then became very important in the computer culture. And I wonder if you see any comparisons between the utopian visions of the hippie subculture of the 60s and of the computer subculture that developed in the 80s.
It's not a question of parallels. They're the same thing. At least the hackers who really made the personal computer revolution happen were part of the counterculture. They started at MIT in 1961 and continued right through the 60s and 70s as a very quiet, busy part of the counterculture, creating what turned out to be the only revolution that we really succeeded with.
That's how you see it?
Oh, that's absolutely how I see it. And not only that, it was intentional.
What do you mean?
The personal computer creators wanted to overcome the central mainframe approach to life, and IBM in particular, and they did.
One of the things you use your computer for is to write and design books, and you have a new book called How Buildings Learn that you told me before you actually did on your computer. And tell me about this concept of buildings learning. What do you mean about a building learning?
Well, a peculiarity of buildings is I think it's almost the only major thing that people make that can keep getting better through time,
mm-hmm.
indefinitely, infinitely. But very few buildings actually do that. And early on, six, 7 years ago, I started paying attention to brand new buildings designed by famous architects at vast sums of money that just didn't work at all and couldn't work, couldn't be fixed. And so I started looking at what's that actually made of, what are the problems there, and what kind of buildings do get better over time. And it turned out to be an area that hadn't been looked at. So I spent 6 years studying buildings over time and finding out that it's possible to really work with time in buildings and that there's some principles that you can draw on how to do that.
Now, you live on a houseboat, right?
You bet. I'm on a 1912 tugboat.
So how has your boat been adapted over the years?
It was originally actually a two-masted schooner when it was built in 1912, and then in the 1930s it was probably a hulk, and somebody got the hull and put a tugboat house on it and ran it as a tugboat and a fishing boat for a number of years. And then it was hulked again in San Francisco Bay when my wife and I got it 12 years ago, and then we converted it into a houseboat. And it's pretty interesting. This is the basic preservation story. Preservationists are always taking buildings that were built for one thing and turning them into another use. And that always turns out to release a lot of creativity and innovation. And it's one of the reasons that I think preservation has been such a major success.
What do you like about living on a houseboat?
Well, houseboats have, in a way, it's similar to the well. You're in a very intense community. But because you're surrounded by water, there's also a feeling of great privacy. I mean, you hear the neighbors argue, and you even hear what they're arguing about, but somehow you're not in each other's, stuck in each other's space the way you are in, say, in an apartment building.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stuart Brand, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Stuart Brand is a founder of The Well, a computer conference system, and the creator of the Whole Earth Catalog. His new book is called How Buildings Learn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.